Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Did you ever have one of those Bluetooth headset things?
No, absolutely not. And in fact, like, you know, I definitely have been, you know, the kind of person that buys gadgets and things like that. And these things have always turned me off. Absolutely. Hate them.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way too. And I associate it with like a type, and I keep wondering, like, did Vince Gilligan have a run-in with someone that was wearing one of these things that just rubbed him the wrong way? Because the way that they introduce us to the infamous Ken Wins with the Bluetooth in this episode, and then later when we first meet Saul Goodman, we also see him wearing that same headpiece.
Yeah, it definitely brings to mind a lot, like the way that they introduce, you know, the shot of it in this episode really stands out. The way that, you know, just seeing that, you kind of know what kind of guy this is. And then they use that as a, you know, a shorthand to get us up to speed on what kind of a guy Saul is later when they introduce him in season two. So I think you're right. I think there's definitely, Vince has some sort of history with this device. And I have to say that I agree with them, because I think they are obnoxious.
Yeah, it certainly is synonymous with a certain type of self-important windbag, right? Like real pompous and narcissistic type. But I think it's interesting, sort of the evolution of technology, which is something we've been talking about as we've talked about this show, right? And like now I have my earbuds that I use to listen to music, that I use to, you know, to talk when I'm like, you know, out and about and stuff like that. And I don't have that same association with the newer versions of it anymore. So maybe that's just because they're so ubiquitous, where back then it was just, you know, really rich, like financial advisors or lawyers, other, you know, those types of people that had them.
Yeah. And I think they do. Like I said, I think what you said there is very on point, that it's a kind of person who is okay with just having everyone in the vicinity have to listen to what they're saying on the phone. You know, it's not just that. I mean, I get that it's a convenient way to use your phone when you're busy, but there's the other part of it, the other side of it, where everyone that's near you hears what you're saying. And it's just, like I said, I don't know what other word to use besides obnoxious.
Right. And like they always would speak at such an elevated like volume level, too. I mean, it's just that sort of I've already said like self-important, but it's noise pollution. Right. So I went out of town recently and I was at the airport. I was at my gate and there was this guy laying on the floor. Right. So he had his like he was stretched out, like everyone's crammed together in those like little seats at the gate. And he's lying on the floor and he's talking on his phone. So he's not using the earpiece, but it made me think of the same thing, right? I was reminded of this guy as I was watching this episode, and he's talking on his phone and he's like FaceTiming or whatever it is. So not only did I have to hear him, I had to hear the guy he was talking to as well. And I must have been staring at him the same way that Walt was glaring at the back of Ken's head in the credit union in this episode. But I don't know, it's funny.
Indeed.
Yeah, so I have a couple of little factoids about Bluetooth. Do you know where it gets its name from?
Nope, I have no idea.
I didn't know this either, but maybe other people knew this, but it comes from the 10th century Danish king named Harald Bluetooth, who purportedly had a passion for tooth-staining blueberries, and that's where he got the nickname from. I don't know if that's true or not. I know I read another thing that said he had like a dead tooth, and that's why it was called Bluetooth, but he is most notable for uniting Denmark and Norway. And when the industry leaders from Intel, Ericsson and Nokia got together in 1996 to make a standardized plan for this this new technology, this short-range radio technology, the idea was that they were uniting in somewhat the same way that he, I guess.
Oh, yeah. You know, I was wondering where the connection was coming because that just seemed completely random.
Yeah. So this guy, Jim Kardak, I don't know if I said that right, from Intel suggested Bluetooth as a temporary code name. And he's been quoted as saying King Harald Bluetooth was famous for uniting Scandinavia, just as we intend to unite the PC and cellular industries with a short range wireless link.
Fascinating.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's that fascinating, but those early ones, like, you only really saw it from a couple of different models. And there was a lot of interest in what kind of earpiece Saul wore, both in Breaking Bad and in Better Call Saul. And we were able to finally figure it out during the final season of Better Call Saul, where we got that shot of it up close. And his was a Motorola H500 headset.
Yeah, there was a little episode teaser with it sitting there, huh?
We got new players in town. Now, we don't know who they are, where they come from, but they possess an extremely high skill set. I mean, personally, thinking Albuquerque just might have a new kingpin.
This is Growth Decay Transformation, a Breaking Bad rewatch podcast. I'm Courtney.
And I'm Pete.
And we're joined by our producer, Talitha Barco. So, Pete, can you give us a recap of Season 1, Episode 4, Cancer Man?
Yeah, and Cancer Man, is that an X-Files connection? You're more of an X-Files rememberer than I am.
It is, yes. Yeah. So for those who don't know or maybe didn't make the connection, in The X-Files, the main villain of that series is played by William B. Davis. And his name, like on the credits, is as Smoking Man.
Yeah, that's what I always remembered him as, was Smoking Man. That's why I didn't know if it was a direct reference or if it was something that they just sort of were like a... throwing it out there so that we can make the connection. But you said that they do actually refer to him as Cancer Man, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, he's credited as the Cigarette Smoking Man, but actually within the show, Mulder, the main character, and Scully come up with this pejorative, I guess, for him. They call him Cancer Man, right? And because he is like Walt, the cancer of the show, right? He is their arch nemesis. And, you know, I was thinking about this and also in a lot of ways, like Walt, his intentions are often like ambiguous, and there's been even like a lot of debate about just how bad he really is. So I know
maybe
that
the cancer man is actually right, like that kind of thing.
Well, he thinks so. The actor himself has said so. So Chris Carter, the creator of The X-Files, once called him the devil, and that created a lot of controversy among fans, and including William B. Davis himself, because many of them see him as a hero who's forced to make choices that others are unwilling to make. Like, he's doing the tough, hard things that nobody else wants or can do. So, I mean, he's part, for those of you that don't know, he's part of this shadow organization that's comprised of all these government higher ups, and they're working together to, you know, keep the existence of aliens secret and whatever it is that they're trying to do. But he does some really despicable, horrible things throughout the series. But he is, again, like Walt, an interesting character in so far that there is a lot of debate over, like, whether is he a hero? Is he a villain? You know, so that's up for the viewers to decide.
Yeah, and you are definitely much more of an X-Files rememberer than I am. I watched it. I really enjoyed it, but I don't remember any of that stuff to that kind of detail. So getting back to our cancer man, Walter White, season 1, episode 4. The episode opens with Hank at work. He's giving a DEA briefing about the meth they recovered in Crazy Eight's car. You know, it's 99.1% pure. And he shares his belief that Albuquerque has a new kingpin. At a barbecue at the White House, Skyler breaks down in tears, forcing Walt to tell Hank about his cancer. Marie and Walter Jr. are there, and this is kind of a big deal because nobody knew except for him, and then, you know, she knew. So now his whole family knows what's going on, and Marie volunteers to use her connections to help them to put together a dream team of doctors, and Walt agrees, maybe begrudgingly agrees at that point, and she does come through, but they find out that the oncologist is outside of their HMO, and they're going to have to come up with $5,000 just for the consultation, like the first time they meet him. This episode also introduces us to Jesse's friends Combo and Skinny Pete. And it's kind of funny because in the script, they were referred to as a skinny stoner and a chubby stoner. And obviously, they made an impression and they went on to become characters with names. And they'll do a lot more in the rest of the series. But after he's hanging out with them, he has a moment there where he doesn't want to smoke and because he's feeling paranoid, but he gives in and... After that, he sort of has some hallucinations there, and his paranoia drives him to go outside of the house, and he ends up at his childhood home, where we find out that he has a younger brother named Jake, and that his parents care about him, but they have a lot of history with having to deal with him whenever stuff like this happens. They're mixed on how they feel about him showing up at their house. When Walt goes to the credit union to exchange his drug money... to get a cashier's check to pay for the oncologist, there's a loud, obnoxious financial advisor driving a BMW with the vanity plate Ken Wins, and he steals a parking spot that Walt was waiting for. Total violation. He was waiting. You could see him, and he stole it. And I just want to throw in there before I finish this off that I really like the vanity plate Ken Wins. I wonder how long they actually workshopped that in the writer's room, because that is just a real winner right there. And so Skylar and Walt, they meet the doctor, they discuss treatment options, and then back at home, when Skylar wants to schedule the first appointment, Walt isn't, he's not okay with the idea that he's going to leave her with debt if something would happen. Upset by his father's reluctance, Walter Jr. has a big moment, and he tells Walt that he should just go ahead and die. And at the end of the episode, while driving, Walt has a coughing fit that forces him to pull over near a gas station, where he spots that same yuppie jerk from the credit union, and stuff happens after that.
Ken loses.
Yeah. So what were your overall impressions of this fourth episode?
Well, apart from that very explosive ending, this is, I think, a somewhat quieter episode. I would characterize it primarily as a character study and an examination of how each of the characters apply themselves and relate to those around them. I would say that what stood out to me most was the role of family and how those familial dynamics and relationships shape both Jesse and Walt, and how in both cases they're perceived as needing help and they're treated by their families almost as though they're like inept children. And while their situations are different, you know, Walt has cancer, Jesse has maybe a drug problem, there are a lot of parallels between them that I think this episode really highlights. So you could say that Jesse and Walt are two sides of the same coin. They appear to be opposites, but there are a lot of similarities between them. And I think this episode further highlights that both characters have something to prove to the world and to themselves. And then, of course, that big moment at the end, I love so much. It does leave an impression. What about you? What did you think?
Well, yeah, I agree that it is quieter. But I also think it's a great episode to discuss in this format, like rewatching, because it a lot of this stuff hits differently in hindsight. That and last scene you're talking about is a great example. I mean, that's just such a cool scene. It's the first instance where we see someone walking away from an explosion without reacting, you know, like wow, I'm so cool, I can't even be bothered to be scared by the explosion thing that we'll see so many times, you know, with the cousins when they blow up the truck, and even in Better Call Saul whenever Gus blows up Los Pollos. It's fantastic, but when you see it the first time, you don't know who Walt is or who he's going to become. So it's a lot different. You're just sort of like, yeah, that guy deserved it. You know, I'm happy to see it. Now, you know, it has a totally different meaning. And the first time I watched it, I didn't recognize that they were essentially doing the same thing with both characters, you know, splitting them up so that you could see how they go through to highlight the differences in their character. It's a bit of a reset because they got out of the situation with Crazy 8 and Emilio that was dominating the last couple of episodes. So it's a great way to set up the dynamic of how they'll use them to complement each other throughout the rest of the series. Two smaller things that really jumped out on the rewatch were the look on Walt's face when Hank promises to take care of his family if something were to happen. This is a great little bit of facial acting by Bryan Cranston there. And also, this is a really interesting Skyler episode. We see Anna Gunn do some great stuff in this episode too, which you kind of overlook at the time. In the same way that they use Jesse's decision not to rat out Jake as like a contrast to the decisions that Walt makes, they use her to do the same thing at home. So I thought that was really good. You know, she has this sort of normal human being reaction to the idea of treatment and, you know, like, don't die. Let's do everything we can so that you don't die, even if it means that we have to borrow some money. And that really, you don't really catch it at the time, but you see later how strange of a man that Walter White is. And, you know, there's just a lot of little, great little character seeds that are planted here. And, you know, they don't jump out at you, but of course they'll all bear their fruit down the road. And, in that way, I think it's a pretty impressive episode.
Don't forget your pants. We'll be right back after this short break.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and ball move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. First two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV Plus, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Fire
fire up the RV. We're back with more growth, decay, and transformation.
Yeah, absolutely agreed. And you touched on a lot of points that I want to delve into deeper as we get into this conversation more. But something that we both said, I guess, that stood out to us in our impressions of this episode is the parallels between Walt and Jesse. So I want to look at those first and look at some of those parallels. So one thing that occurred to me as I was watching this episode was, as I already mentioned, of course, is that you see this sort of familial dynamic between Walt and his family. And then you see it with Jesse and his family as well. And this idea of going home, right? And I'm reminded of a really great line. And I think I mentioned it in our previous podcast when we were talking about episode 3, in an exchange between Crazy 8 and Walt, when he's about to let him go. And he says, "Whatever, man, I just want to go home." And Walt says, "Me too." And we remarked in the podcast that that's not really possible for them to actually go back to where they came from. But I think we see both Walt and Jesse trying to do that. They're trying to return to some sort of sense of normalcy, right? So for Walt, he wants things to go back to normal before the whole fiasco and the whole mess of what happened with Emilio and Crazy 8. And I think we get to see how...
And in a way, before he had cancer too, right?
Exactly. Because but now, like, he's kind of...
That's still new news in his life. You know, it's kind of funny when you think about it that he's coming off a murder. Not a murder, maybe. You know, he killed for... You whatever, but you know, like he's still only 2 weeks into or a month into a cancer diagnosis, which is a literal death sentence. So I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but I just
that
popped in my head when you were talking.
I don't know that I would agree that maybe he wants to return back to before the cancer diagnosis. He seems kind of, at this point to me, the way I read it, kind of resigned to that reality. And we see as he's kind of committed to the idea of dying. And that's an idea that will be explored both in this episode and in later episodes. But I think the real issue for Walt is, though, that now he has to deal with his family, right? Because he had to tell them that he had cancer. That was how he explained to Skyler why he's been behaving strangely. But now he has to deal with the fallout from that. And that's something that he doesn't want to deal with, right? And with Jesse, we see him return back home to his family, to the safety of his childhood home when he's feeling paranoid, when he's feeling stressed. And so I think there's some interesting parallels that happen there, although different, right? So it's impossible for both of them to return home, but for different reasons. And it's with Jesse, it's also deals with like this idea of like illness. And I mentioned that both families kind of treat them like they're inept in some way. Mm-hmm. And I think with... we see it with Walt in a very particular way, like how his family all wants to make decisions for him, right? And Skyler even at one point says, you know, we're a family, we go through these things together. And it sort of denies the individual like agency, right? Mm-hmm. Not to say that this is a bad thing. I'm not saying like, you know, family shouldn't care, they don't have a say or anything like that. That's not what I'm saying. But it's just like those dynamics of like the family versus the individual is something that plays out in a really interesting way in both scenarios. So mm-hmm. we have Walt with his illness with cancer, and then we have Jesse with the perceived illness of like drug addiction, right? His parents, we see them talking about like, what do you think he's on? Should we let him stay? And the family's
also,
like, on...
I mean, Jesse, where he lives, there's a hole in the floor from the body that they tried to disincorporate. You know, like he's also having trouble going back to where he actually lives because of what's happened there too, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, there are like other reasons why he would want to leave that
house. He might not be completely like owning his addiction or his drug use, but there's other things going on too, I guess, is what I want to point out.
Well, I think in a way he does. I think in an interesting way he does. It's almost like it's a silent recognition of like this idea his parents have of him as a junkie. And it's really, I think, accepting the role that's been cast on him as the black sheep, as the outcast, whatever you want to call it. And there was something you were talking about with his brother that I also wanted to talk about, because I thought it was, again, sort of an interesting parallel between Walt and Jesse in terms of like opposite reactions to things. So Jesse makes the decision to protect his little brother when the housekeeper finds the joint, right? Mm-hmm. He takes the fall for his brother. And it's like a certified family, like, motive almost and ethic that he has. So he doesn't take the opportunity to throw him under the bus. And it's in stark contrast to how Walt is constantly blaming things on other people. Like, he does not take any responsibility. So Jesse decides to take the fall. He's a loyal person. Mm-hmm. And that's something, again, like a something about Jesse that I think gets returned to over and over again, this idea of loyalty, the good dog, bad dog, mm-hmm. you know, thing that happens later. But furthermore, this idea that Jesse doesn't take the opportunity to like avenge himself when his parents, you know, confront him. He doesn't say, it wasn't me, it was Jake. But Walt absolutely takes the opportunity to avenge himself in this episode at the end when he decides to enact that revenge on Ken. So yeah. Again, I think it's a really interesting look at how these two different characters respond differently to the opportunity that they have to avenge themselves in a way.
Yeah, with hindsight, it's really straightforward. You know, the this is the core of their characters. They both have a similar situation, like you just pointed out. And Jesse, he does the honorable thing in the situation. And I mean, you could argue that he doesn't think that he's worth the redemption or something like that. You know, but he could have used that as a thing. I mean, he doesn't want to go home. There's real issues going on. That's sort of why I brought that up earlier. So he does want to stay at his family's house, but it's more important to him to not throw his brother under the bus. And mm-hmm. you know, you see that come out in a totally different way whenever Walt blows up Ken Wins's car.
Yeah, definitely. So another thing I noticed in terms of like another parallel between Walt and Jesse is this desire and maybe lack of desire to want to talk about certain things, which I think, again, further reveals how each of these characters deal with pressure. So when Jesse goes to the White House to talk to Walt, right, and he says he wants to debrief, and that's when he also gives him the money, they have this exchange, and he's very condescending. He mocks him, like, debrief? What is there to talk about? He doesn't want to talk about. There's nothing to talk about. Or Jesse very much wants to talk. And you see something happen later with Skylar and Walt when she's asking, is it okay for me to make that first appointment for treatment? And he's like, we need to talk about this more. And she says, what is there to talk about? You're doing this, right? So again, this idea of like wanting to talk about certain things, but not wanting to talk about other things. So it's, I think, again, an interesting little parallel between those two characters in terms of how they're relating to others.
It gets to the perspective of the different characters in the same situations. You know, like I said, I think there's a lot of a great contrast there. And also just they're important. It's important information for us as viewers to sort of file away so that we understand how they act later. Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That,
yeah, for sure.
That's one thing. And I just wanted to backtrack a second, because one of the things that you mentioned there was the debrief, and that's the point in the episode when I'm rewatching that I realize, oh yeah, like they just killed someone in the last episode, you know, because it kind of goes so far away from that. And then you realize, hey, they're holding all of that stuff in throughout the entire episode. It's driving what they're doing. But I really like how they approach that here, because like I said, it's sort of a reset, and they do it in such a way that you almost kind of, with everything else that's going on with Walt in the beginning having to admit that he has cancer to his family, you kind of forget like where they are, you know, right before that, because of, you know what I mean, because they go on these two different paths that are unrelated.
It is interesting to be reminded, or it's important to be reminded of where they are coming from, and this idea of wanting to go back to normal but not being able to, and seeing how they both respond to that, which is, which makes me think of this other point I wanted to make about Jesse, right? So in the past couple episodes, we see how Jesse deals with pressure. He turns to meth, right? And he tells us, Skinny Pete and Combo, when they ask if he's got any of that crystal, that he's been laying off of it because it's been making him paranoid and he's trying to, like, you know, do it for health reasons. And he caves to a little bit of the peer pressure there. So they're like, well, whatever, we'll bounce. You know, it's cool if you don't want to share. And he's like, no, I'm just joking. I'm joking. And then, of course, he smokes with them. And we see the effect that has on him when he imagines, like, you know, Hell's Angels or whatever, like the biker gang coming up to the door. And again, just one of those other parallels with Walt is how he, at this point, is also somewhat caving to peer pressure. So we see both characters doing things that they don't want to do, that is against their own better judgment. And it's not as he obviously, Walt will push back against this later on in the series when they have the whole little talking pillow intervention, where he finally speaks his mind. But when they're sitting in the family room, this is almost like the precursor to that. And Marie is saying, like, oh, I'm going to get on the phone with my radiologist, yada yada, we're going to put together this dream team. And Skylar is responding, like, yes, this sounds great, you know, we need a second opinion. And she's like, I'm going to call first thing in the morning. And Skylar says, yeah. And she looks to Walt to see if he'll agree to that. And he says, you used the word begrudgingly earlier when you were doing the recap of this episode, and that's the perfect way to describe it. He agrees to it begrudgingly. He is also caving to a type of peer pressure, perhaps, or familial pressure, and you can tell he really doesn't want to do it. And you mentioned, you know, the look on his face when when Hank says to him, you know, I hope you know I'll always take care of your family. And I think that's another really key moment.
Yeah. And in case you missed that, you know, they do a couple more in the same episode, just so that it really resonates. When she mentions his mother, he kind of has that same look on his face. And there's one other instance.
Well, could it be when they're talking about the money, right? So they need $5,000 just to get into the door, right? Just to have that initial consult with the oncologist. Mm-hmm. And he's like, she floats the idea, we could always borrow from Hank. And he very forcefully says, absolutely not.
That was the one I was thinking.
Is that
about
the moment?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's really, like, great foreshadowing.
Yeah. And it almost comes in, you can almost see a buildup in it if you look at it like that too. Like the first one, okay. Second one, it's really starting to grate on. By the third one, absolutely not. You know what I mean? Like you could see that over the course of the thing, of the episode, build up to where it's an issue. It's not an issue we know about, but it's something that's going to pay off later.
Absolutely. And this foreshadows what happens in the next episode in Gray Matter, right? When the way that he turns down Elliot Schwartz's offer, both for the job and then when he outright offers to pay for his treatment and he refuses. So we get to see how Walt's pride is starting to play a role in this, right? Like he wants to do this all by himself. And certainly by the end of the episode, we really see that this is someone that's determined to do things his own way and doesn't care anymore.
Yeah. It's an ongoing transformation, but it's always happening, huh?
It is. And I think the relationship with Hank is one that we could talk a little bit more about, because we did talk about it in that first episode we did, the first podcast, but we didn't touch on all of the points that we had spoken about off air, right? And we had some really great points about that relationship with Hank and the family in general. I know you want to talk about Skylar. I also want to talk about Skylar. And I think this episode is so important in showing us these family dynamics and how they all relate to each other. So,
yeah. Yeah, I thought that there is it's a little, it's not as direct, but I think that there, you kind of see a little bit, like Hank, you brought up Hank, and in the opening scene, I think there's a little bit of a parallel with him and him starting out on his quest too. He's not yet obsessed, but you know, this 99.1% thing comes out and there's some new players in town. He thinks there's a new kingpin. Like this is the origin of the thing that will eventually bring him down too, right?
That also stood out to me. And I think we see Hank apply himself in a way that's going to be important for the rest of the series.
I see what
right?
You did so there, this... huh? Apply yourself.
Exactly. So apply yourself, of course, being a reference to the old test that Jesse finds in his childhood room, his old chemistry test, where he had drawn this crude cartoon of Walt. And then on the other side, he flips it over and he got an F on the paper and big red letters. It says ridiculous, apply yourself.
Yeah, and another great moment, you know, like, I mean, the like facial acting and just character centric all the way around. I mean, he sees that, he has this great memory of making fun of Mr. White and then flips it over and is brought back to reality of like what their situation was like whenever he was his teacher.
Definitely. And I love that scene. That's one of my favorite moments in the episode, is Jesse sitting cross-legged on his bedroom floor in front of his like old toy chest, pulling out his old toys. And he comes upon this this old test that he failed miserably on.
Yeah.
But then something interesting happens right after that. So like you see him laughing, and then the look on his face, how crestfallen he is when he turns it over and he sees that message, that what Walt had written. And then immediately after that, he gets that phone call from Combo asking if he has any more meth to sell. And what does Jesse do? He applies himself.
Yeah,
exactly. And so I was thinking of how when trying to think of a title for this podcast episode, I thought apply yourself would work well, because we start to see all the characters start to apply themselves the way that they will throughout the rest of the series. So we see Jesse is starting to take a little bit more initiative and trying to prove himself. So the image of him, though, sitting cross-legged like a little kid on his floor playing with his like old toys. Mm-hmm. I mean, they really show him as a kid, as a child.
Yeah.
And he's this disappointment to his family. He's the black sheep. You know, he was a failure in high school. Now he has an opportunity to actually prove himself. And to go back to what you were saying about Hank, because I did want to also mention that, we get to see him discover the meth and this quest to catch this new kingpin that's going to drive him, propel him for the rest of the series. So this is really where he gets to apply himself. And it's not so obvious at this point, right? But as he's coming up with the theory that the meth was made right here in Albuquerque, no one's really pushing back yet. But as we see as the series progresses, everyone doubts Hank. You know, they all think he's, you know, obsessed with catching this mystery man, and nobody takes it as seriously as he does. So it really is the beginning of the hero's quest for him to catch him. And of course, and then we see Walt apply himself at the end when he blows up Kent's car.
Yeah. And back to Hank for a quick second. It's funny that, like you said, that they bring up Crazy Eight. That's sort of the end of that story. And I feel like they kind of throw out that little detail there that, you know, that he was turning people in. He was taking over their territory after they were arrested. And that the last person that he turned in was his cousin. So, you know, a lot of that stuff that's underneath all the stuff that we saw him in their conversation, you know, like the ways that he endeared himself to Walter whenever Walter was looking for a reason not to kill him, right? And it just kind of says for sure that if he would have let him go, then that he would have killed him for sure, right?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. So I was, because they tried to connect the story or explain how Crazy Eight became an informant for the DEA. They explain this in Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
And that's when he gets picked up, when that's when like they're trying to drop the meth down the drain pipe. It's at that moment, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. 5-0.
When he gets picked up. And then they send in Saul, the cartel does. They send in Saul to be his lawyer, and like it's like a pretend like informant sort of mm-hmm. thing. So like he's still working, like it's not like he's really turned his back on the cartel. They know he is like and you know, doing this with the DEA. So
it's,
I was curious though, because Yeah, so I was curious, did he really turn in Emilio? I mean, did he turn him in? Or is that something that is actually ever confirmed, or is that just like implied?
I mean, implied in Breaking Bad. Hank says it in this episode.
Oh, does he? I missed that. I would have to go back and watch that.
Yeah.
But it's certainly implied or explicitly stated in this episode, but the way they did it in Better Call Saul, I was just curious, like, what happened after, you know, like, Lalo dies and everything.
Yeah. I mean, that is interesting because it's a darker, he's a much darker character when you meet him here. And you kind of think that he should be a little bit more independent because, like you said, that Lalo dies and he was the one that was kind of giving him orders. But yeah, I haven't really thought about connecting those dots too much since that episode of A Better Call Saul happened. So that's something to think about in the future for sure.
It is. I'm going to be thinking about that for a while.
And we get Skinny Pete in combo. It's nice to see those guys show up. I think whenever you think about, I think that this is kind of another place where you see like how good Aaron Paul is. Like this is kind of like the first episode where we see them, and I think I already said this, but like, you know, where we see them operate independently and where Jesse really becomes a character, you know, like he has his own story that will work in parallel with Walt's rather than him just being comic relief or, you know, Walt's entry into the underworld or whatever. And, yeah, it's good to see like that he can pull off this stuff where he's high, when he's hanging out with his friends, when he's trying to be cool, when he has those vulnerable moments like you were talking about, whenever he's there seeing, you know, looking through his stuff in his childhood room. And he, you know, like I didn't, the first time I watched the series, I didn't realize how much good stuff he was doing, because really I would just think of him as, you know, the funny stuff he did stood out more than anything.
Yeah. And I think this episode, maybe more than any up to this point, really sets Jesse up as like the main supporting character of the series. We get to spend so much time with Jesse in this episode and get to know him and see him in a context outside of his relationship to Walt, I think is something worth noting, because something we've been talking about on this podcast, right, is how we only really get to see the other characters through Walt's point of view. And we get to see this exception here with Jesse. I mean, we get to see other characters somewhat behind this, like, you know, little glimpses into their lives. So like Hank, you know, at his DEA briefing, and then we get to see Skylar sometimes, you know, hanging out with her sister Marie and talking. But usually those are all things that relate to Walt, right? So of course we're following the cat and mouse game that's going to start happening with Walt and Hank, so knowing what Hank is up to at this point. And but like the way that Skylar, whenever she's, whatever scenes she has, it's always just like with her and her sister, and they're usually talking about Walt or their families. Yeah. So really getting to see Jesse as a character in his own right is significant, right? And it's not, again, it's nothing really significant happens in this episode on the surface, but when you really dive into it and start reading, doing this sort of character analysis and examining, like, where are they right now? Like, where are they coming from after the disaster of the previous episode, and where they're going? You said, Pete, earlier that this plants a lot of little seeds, and I think that's an astute observation. I think it really does. We get to see, like, where these characters are, and that primes us to better understand where they end up.
And you mentioned that, you know, what happened before. And one of those really nice touches here is how you can see the Tampico branding on the crib whenever he's in the room with, you know, taking the money out of the vent, and Walter Jr. comes in. You can see the Tampico furniture, which is connected to Crazy Eight's father's store there. Something I don't think that I would have picked up on the first time I watched it, but something that people definitely noticed, and you appreciate that, you know, you appreciate those little details.
Yeah, and while we're talking about like where the characters are, like how they're thinking, how they're feeling at this particular time, I think that they decided to show him put the money in that space, in that room. Of course, allowed them to show that little Tampico sticker, but the way that they cut that scene, I think, is really interesting, right? So in the conversation he has with Junior, Junior says, "What the hell is wrong with you? Why are you acting so weird?" And then, you know, a couple seconds later, we get to see the sticker. So it's just like they're subtly letting the viewer know, if you're paying attention, like those eagle-eyed viewers, like, this is why he's acting weird, right? Like, don't forget that he just, you know, killed this man.
Yeah, totally understandable reaction there, teenager, but your dad just killed somebody, like, really recently.
Yeah.
So Walt Jr., pretty good. It's a pretty good Walt Jr. episode, too. I mean, he definitely brings some heat with his line later.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does. And again, this is another one of those like little parallels I noticed between Walt and Jesse, and the way their families treat them and kind of hover over them. We see that happen with Junior when Walt at the end of the school day is going into his classroom, maybe to, you know, pack up, finish grading, whatever he's doing at the end of the day, and he sees Junior sitting at one of the tables, looking at a microscope, and he's surprised to see him, like, oh, you're not taking the bus. And in the way like Junior looks at him, it's a silent scene. Junior doesn't actually say anything, but you get the sense that like his Junior is, it's almost like an inverse in the roles there, in terms of like father son, like the Junior is acting more concerned about his dad at this point, like the way that, like, you know, a parent might be concerned about their child, like, why are you behaving strangely? This is something serious. You know, this is something that we need to consider, is that very much the impression I got. And this idea of like this sort of, again, this intrusion, not that it's unwarranted or anything like that. I don't want that to carry a negative connotation, but you see that also with Jesse when he's with his little brother and the mother busts in the room, right? And she's, again, this sort of like intrusion. So you get the sense of like how like the family is intruding on these characters.
Two quick things about Jesse's family. One, I think they come off more sympathetic here, huh? And when you first meet them, like, they feel kind of cruel and heartless. At least that's the way I remember it right now, not having rewatched the series recently, but just sort of kind of, you know, cutting him off. Here you get a pretty good idea of why that is. Pretty natural, a pretty natural response for parents who are struggling with this sort of thing, not knowing what to do with it. And the other thing I think this is the first time that we see one of my favorite things, which is the time lapse shot.
Yeah, with the house.
Which is fantastic. Those always grab my attention whenever they use one of those.
Yeah, it's very effective.
I guess here they're showing how long he passes out after he comes down from his high. But yeah, that's one of my favorite little Breaking Bad visual tricks that they do that we'll see throughout the series.
Well, it's interesting you bring up the parents and like at least how the sort of general consensus of viewers, of fans to them. And of course, it's the moment like when he buys the house, you know, later on he has Saul, you know, seal the deal. That's a really great moment for Jesse. And I think his parents are those kinds of characters that people kind of just absolutely despise and hate. And Skylar is another one of those.
They are difficult from this point on, but this is here that I just don't think you really remember this as much whenever you think about them later, right?
Yeah, and to your point though, like when you really think about this objectively, like they have every reason to be concerned of their son, right? So to have this word for him in this case, you know, they're accusing him of something, or they believe he did something that he didn't do. It wasn't his joint that they found, but he did come to their house after being high on meth and, you know, being partaking in murder, or at least being accessory to
lawn
furniture
or new patio furniture, whatever it was.
Yeah, so their feelings are absolutely warranted, just like Walt's family's feelings are warranted. Like, how would any of you out there listening feel in these situations if it was your child who showed up high and then slept for 24 hours or 12 hours, however long he was passed out? And or how would you feel if your loved one had cancer and didn't tell anyone and was acting the way Walt is acting, you know? It forces us to hopefully consider that point of view.
Absolutely.
And how they feel. So Yeah, you mentioned earlier that this is an interesting Skylar episode, so we haven't really spoken all that much about Skylar on the podcast yet. So I was wondering if you wanted to dive into Skylar.
Yeah, and I think just to start it off a little bit, I think what really hit me watching this was, I mean, Anna Gunn really sells her concern for Walt and she shares his bewilderment with the situation, and she's just dealing with it in her way, right? And I really like that. I mean, they didn't really have to go to that length to sell that, you know. And it just is another one of those instances where you see, you know, how they really take care to sketch these characters out. Like, she smiles at this one point, like, you know, like, oh, that's good, you know, and I just thought that was such a great, you know, just contrast to the way that Walt is experiencing things.
Agreed. I know some people were, like, annoyed about how she starts crying and that forces him into a position where he has to tell the rest of the family that he has cancer.
Really? I mean, that seems like a pretty human response to me.
I agree. And, like, also she's pregnant, you know, so she's pregnant. Yeah. So she's got all the pregnancy hormones going on. And the story that Hank is telling is this sweet story about how they began dating, right? So mm-hmm. she's, at the way I watch it, right, I think of it as like a tender moment where she's reflecting on her love for her husband, and it becomes overwhelming for her, and she starts crying. I think Skylar gets a lot of unjustified.
Yeah, I mean,
hate.
What is the implication of someone who didn't like it think that she faked the crying and that it was a way to force his hand, or what's the criticism?
I don't know, because I don't know if there's anyone out there listening who felt that way. Maybe let us know, because I don't know how to answer that.
I mean, that was it felt organic to me. Like it she just broke down because of the pressure she's been under from having to keep this secret, right? That's the way it plays.
I agree. I mean, and also, of course, it furthers the plot, right? Like, he has to tell the rest of the family, so it serves that purpose as well.
In a way, she lets him off the hook, if you think about it, without any kind of emotion. He's having trouble. I mean, he has to tell people, but he can't really do it. So, as you said, it actually pushes him along in that direction.
Yeah. Yeah, but again, like, thinking of you were talking about, like, her reaction and her tenderness, and I picked up on that too watching this. I got the sense very much that she cares about her husband, she cares about her family, and she wants him to fight this, and she wants him to survive, and she wants him to live. And
they're all kind of dealing with that dissonance too, right? So whenever you see her, she tries to come up with she wants to make sense of it, and she wants to have a reason for why it's happening, like we all do when we find ourselves with that kind of bad news. And so she's thinking, oh, it must have been your time at the lab whenever they didn't give you the right. It's somebody else's fault. There's a reason, and, you know, it's unfair, and however you work through that on a personal level.
Yeah, I think that's part of, like, the grieving process too. So getting like a terminal diagnosis for many people and their families can begin a grieving process. So there's, like, bargaining, there's denial and things like that. So that's another way you might be able to read the characters and the way they respond. Both Walt, who's seems to be at many times in a state of denial, like he just doesn't want to deal with this, right? Like, just
yeah.
And I think that tinnitus that we hear, right? So we heard it in the pilot with the mustard stain scene when the doctor is telling him that, you know, he's got cancer. And then you hear it again when they meet with Dr. Del Cavoli, the oncologist, in this episode, and they start talking about the possible side effects. And that's when, again, he sort of tunes out, and it's, you know, it's an auditory, I guess, technique for storytelling, visual storytelling, TV shows, to let us know that the character is withdrawing, sort of checking out, not able to process. So I think Walt is very much in a state of denial, not wanting to deal with this. And as he told Crazy Eight in the previous episode, it's not a conversation he's even remotely ready to have. And I think that's still true. It's not something he wants to talk about until Skylar's like, we're going to do treatment. And he's like, no, we do need to talk about this, actually. You know, is this the way to go?
Yeah, because I guess that's something that's easier for him to think about, like whether he'll have enough money or not. You know, it's more empirical. It's not it doesn't require him to really face what's happening to him at the end of his life.
And something that we talked about, Pete, in a YouTube video that we made for your channel leading up to our podcast, so before the podcast actually came out, we made this video called, like, Why You Need to Rewatch Breaking Bad, or Why It's Time to Rewatch Breaking Bad. Maybe we'll drop the link below in the description if you wanted to check that out. But one of the things we were talking about in terms of the legacy of the show is how it gives us this, like, unique snapshot of America at this point in time, and what was going on in this country, and how, like, maybe like Walt's reality of not having the best healthcare, not making the most money, are also things that lead him, of course, to make the decisions that he makes. And so just to contextualize this a little bit more, this episode is set in October of 2008, and the Affordable Care Act, you know, didn't come out until March 2010. And I did a little research on this as well. I was curious, and I found this document called the Albuquerque Public School Teacher Salary Schedule, and this is the data from 2007 to 2008. And I found that high school teachers, and I looked specifically because they had, like, you know, grades 9 through 12. I looked at 11th and 12th grade because you don't take chemistry until 11th grade. So I'm assuming he's teaching juniors and seniors, maybe some advanced sophomores. But the upper classmen teachers, right, teachers who teach juniors and seniors, made somewhere between $30,000 and $38,000 a year. And that range is based on both degree and experience. So the lower end is like a bachelor's degree, maybe with fewer years of experience, and $38,000 being like the max for someone with a PhD teaching high school. So that's pretty abysmal, right? That's pretty bad.
So whenever they say $90,000 for treatment, you're talking about 3 years' salary.
Essentially, yeah. And I don't know how much he would have been drawing from his, you know, his job at the car wash, but it couldn't have been, you know, much more than that. And
no, it's not even full time. Yeah.
Yeah. And so something I was thinking about in terms of, like, these pressures from, like, finances and maybe somewhat like an indictment of our healthcare system in the United States as well, right? Made me think about something that this French sociologist, Emile Durkheim, said, who's famous for his ideas on deviancy and like social labeling theory. But essentially, as a quick little, like, I don't know, in a nutshell, what his argument is that all forms of deviance are simply a challenge to normalize repressiveness of the state. So in other words, if there's something wrong with society, criminality is a response to that, right? Yeah. And I think this was something that you explored a little bit in a bonus episode with Jim and Aaron, right?
Yeah, so the point that Aaron made was that this might lose its relevancy. You could see an interpretation of this where Walt did this because he had no other way to pay for this treatment, right? Because the healthcare system doesn't exist to help people who have who are dying of cancer necessarily. He's moved to crime, right? And it was when I was talking to Aaron, he brought up the point about, we were talking about how will this show ever lose its relevancy? Because, like, you know, 15 years on, this stuff is all pretty relevant to how we are. The world hasn't changed all that much. The world that a guy like Walter White lives in. And he brought up the idea that, yeah, you know, maybe if we have universal health care and things like that, to where this wouldn't make sense to the next generation of why he would go to these lengths.
Yeah, but
so that was a pretty interesting point, you know.
That is a really great point, but then at the same time, like, Breaking Bad has universal appeal and it is enjoyed and very popular in countries where they do have socialized healthcare or universal healthcare. So that must be so weird for people that don't live in the United States that live somewhere where they do have universal healthcare. If that is you, if anyone out there listening lives in a country where you have access to universal healthcare, did you find this really strange? You know, that makes me think of something.
From my own personal experience of like traveling to Europe when I was a younger man, like I couldn't believe, like, you know, because I guess you just always have the idea that for some reason America, you know, the standard of living is so high and everything is great. Like, I couldn't believe when I went through Scandinavia and places like that, and just how much how different it was in places where there's actually a social safety net and people get healthcare. It's a huge difference. You can feel it.
And also, you reminded me of this earlier, Pete. Probably this is a good place to mention this. I had seen an interview with Anna Gunn, who plays Skylar, and she was being interviewed by someone in Australia, and while the show was still on, and they were shocked to find out that a teacher had to work a second job. Like, that was like such a foreign concept to them, that a teacher would have to, you know, supplement their income by working at something like a car wash, because, you know, in Australia and in other countries, you know, they pay their teachers a lot better than they do here.
Yeah, I mean, it's a job that needs to be done, and it's pretty obvious that if you want to have you want those people to do a good job with the kids, you know, like, you, I mean, my dad is actually a high school teacher. So, you know, I dealt with this growing up. It's really kind of backwards the way that works here.
Yeah. And when you look at Breaking Bad through this lens of how it's like a critique of some of these institutional sort of systemic problems and what it says about the American capitalist system, that's like a whole other conversation. Maybe there's like a bonus episode in there in that conversation. I don't know. There's a lot we could say about that.
And at the same time, I just want to say that one of the things that works really well about this, though, is that it's all there, but it's treated as normal. It's not elevated on some kind of political angle, right?
It's just
this is the way it is for this character in this place, and it's honest and it's real. And that's one of the reasons as why it's still relevant and it'll continue to be relevant, is because it's very it's very true to life in that way, in that sense.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it certainly is not like hitting us over the head with, like, you know, like this sort of political commentary or anything like that. It's just showing the world as it was. And other things that were happening at this unique time period in 2008 was like the housing crisis. So there was a lot of other things happening. So it makes sense to watch what they're going through as a family at this particular point in time. It just adds context to it. And I don't think that the writers were intending to make any sort of intentional commentary about this. That's just like a snapshot of America as it was.
Yeah, I think it's better for it.
I agree. Yeah, and their writing is frequently like that. They don't ever smack us over the head with anything, right? I love, that's one of the things I love most about this universe, both series, right? Is how like they don't really tell you what to think. They kind of show you what you need to know, and it's up to you to piece things together. And it's so
yeah,
well
but
done.
But I mean, I just want to, not that I agree with that, but I think that it's worth mentioning that it's not open-ended either. You know, it's not like it's completely open to interpretation. Like they have a certain direction they're pointing you in, but in just in a really just a well thought out way.
There would be some exceptions, maybe with like Gus and the whole debate over, you know, his sexuality. I think it's very clearly answered in Better Call Saul, but I know some Better Call Saul fans disagree.
Well, yeah, I think there they wanted to. I think there they like the idea that it makes sense. There, I think they make the idea that it works better if you don't know for sure. Like if they preserve the mystery, but then they do kind of answer it, don't they?
I think so.
Yeah, and yeah. So I mean, they do have enduring mysteries for sure. They understand the value of that. I'm just saying that like this isn't some kind of David Lynch production or something like.
Oh where, yeah, no.
You know, like where you're really wondering what's real and what's not real. As far as plot, it's pretty straightforward. But they don't over-explain. They don't force anything down your throat. They just, like you said, they expect that you're paying attention, and they're just deft at actually using that to their advantage.
Yeah, and I guess what I was thinking of in particular when I was talking about that, how like things slowly reveal themselves to you as you watch, but also more than that, I was thinking about the characters themselves. Like they don't explicitly always tell us what they're thinking. They show us like little things, like the little Tampico sticker as like a reminder of like where his head is at the time his son
that
asks him what the hell is wrong with you,
which we'll talk about in a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, so I like that they don't, that there is that mystery there of like it's up to us to sort of to figure out or to consider what are they thinking, what are they feeling, what is motivating them. There are some things that are more explicitly obvious, but you know, there's a reason why we're still talking about this show, and there's a reason why we're still debating whether was he always evil, is he made evil, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Right. So because these things aren't necessarily concrete, they're not necessarily set in stone. There is still opportunity for discussion and debate.
Yeah. You're listening to Growth, Decay, Transformation, and we'll be right back.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Let's get cooking. We're back with more Growth, Decay, Transformation.
Okay, so before we move on to our favorite line and favorite shot, is there anything else you wanted to point out, Pete?
One thing, yeah, there's one thing I did want to get into a little bit, and you touched a little bit on about the paranoia that Jesse was experiencing. And it's a quick shot, it's a quick sequence in here that I always really liked, and it he just got the money from the bank, and he's driving down the road, or he has the money, and he's going to the bank, is the way how it went. But this cop car comes up behind him, and he sees the lights, and so he prepares himself to get pulled over, and it's sort of like, oh, you know, like it's finally they finally caught up to me or something like that, and then it just blows right by, and I really. I guess we've all probably experienced that in real life, you know, where we think we did something and we're going to get pulled over and then the car just goes by. But, yeah, I really love that scene.
I do too. And I actually think like that the scenes with Walt and his encounters or his brief, encounters with law enforcement is like a interesting barometer of his character change, right? So we see in the pilot episode, he hears the sirens. Of course, it's just fire trucks, but he's ready to shoot at them. He's ready to kill himself. Of course, it's the fire trucks. He doesn't have to do that. And then in this episode, we see him pull over. He's nervous. He's paranoid, although he's more in control than obviously he was in the pilot episode. And then certainly
and
by the time...
it just goes on from there.
Yeah. And then the one of the other encounters I think that probably everyone who's seen the series remembers is after the plane crash in their backyard, he gets pulled over for having that cracked windshield, and he's quite aggressive with the officer who ends up pepper spraying him, right? So it is it is an interesting way to sort of trace his evolution as a character. And just one other thing I wanted to mention, since you brought up this idea of paranoia.
They're like little mile markers.
Yeah, it's a great way of thinking of it. Just one other thing I wanted to mention, since we're talking about paranoia. We talked about Jesse's paranoia. He hallucinates, the bikers coming for him. And then we see a little bit of paranoia here with Walt, but also when Jesse goes to the house and he's like, you know, are you wearing a wire? So like this, you can see how both of them are, again, it's just reacting to stress, to pressure, to the horror of what they just went through and how they're both reacting to it. So again, it's something comparable between them, but they of course react in different ways.
Yeah. And there's also that connection of like, it's part of the way that they see themselves too. You know, that's one of the things about that getting pulled over scene. Why that works is because the police officer has, you know, if you're not actually speeding, then really nobody's thinking about what you're doing when you're driving down the road. But from your point of view, from your perspective, the way you see yourself, you think that everyone's always paying attention to you and that everything you're doing is the most important thing that's happening at that moment. So, yeah, I think that's just about it for the main part of what happens in this episode. Is there anything else that we want to touch on before we move into the next phase where we talk about our favorite line?
I think we can go ahead and move on to that next phase.
All righty then. What was your favorite line of Cancer Man?
So I had a little bit of a hard time picking one for this after I watched it the first time. And what stood out to me was the debrief line when Jesse and Walt have that exchange, because it's reminiscent somewhat of that exchange that they have in the pilot when they're talking about the cow house. You know, so that little moment there, that always makes me
laugh.
It's
also funny because of the way that his delivery is. And then Cranston totally matches him by being so just annoyed with the idea that he even brought it up. You know,
he's so condescending to the brief. Yeah. That's what you think when you do the brief, you know. So, but
and I also just really quickly wanted to say that I love the outfit he's wearing there. That's one of the better Walter White outfits, I think, that really sum him up as a character.
Is that the green and white one?
I don't even know. Checkers? It feels like it defies color in a way. Like it's just so drab and invisible that there's, I don't even know. I think it's green and some gray maybe or something.
Yeah, he's in all greens and yellows in this episode, and Skylar is always in blue too. But so as much as I love that line, I rewatched it again, and I realized what my favorite line was within the first couple of minutes of the show, and it comes in the teaser. It's when Hank is doing his DEA thing, and he says, "Albuquerque just might have a new kingpin." It's got to be that one.
Great line. There's some new players in town. One thing I wanted to say about this was when I was watching it this time, and we talked about this off screen, like the shot of Walt that they superimpose with that, you know, and he's kind of looking his softest that he does, and he's kind of goofily brushing his teeth. But I wondered, like, do people actually do that? Like, he has toothpaste all over his face. Like when you brush your teeth, the toothpaste stays inside your mouth, right? That's the way I do it.
I mean,
is this just a thing for TV to like, or are the people out there that get so into the actual brushing that the toothpaste spills out and covers part of their face while they're doing it?
Well, I have been guilty of it spilling out of my face on occasion.
Like that? Like what it looks like that? I mean,
no, not quite that bad. You know? Okay. Not quite that bad, but it is funny that you bring up that shot, because that was one of the shots I was debating for favorite shot, which we'll get to in a second. But he's looking kind of soft. We get him in his tidy whities again. And so this image of him looking so pathetic, you know, brushing his teeth with it, as you said, pouring out of his mouth with the voiceover of Albuquerque has a new kingpin is hilarious, right? Yeah. But it also, it kind of makes him look like a little kid. So when we, in our first episode, Pete, when you were talking about what you think of when you think of tidy whities and you think of it as something like kid wears. And that was, again, one of those like parallels I noticed between Walt and Jesse. I didn't mention it when we were talking about those parallels, but this idea of them looking like children because they're being treated like children. So mm-hmm. we have Jesse sitting cross-legged playing with toys. We have Walt standing there in his underwear. With toothpaste all over his face. So to answer your question about toothpaste all over your face, I think that's something maybe that three to 5 year olds probably do, right? They're
that's
probably
what I
the
would
ones.
Think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what about you? What was your favorite line of the episode?
Two quick points, and then I'll tell you. One, there are way more tidy whitey shots than I remembered. as we keep moving, as a new one comes up, then I remember another one that's going to come later. There's a lot of shots of Walter and Tidy Whitey's here.
Just
the pilot.
There's that one. Is he wearing his tidy whities when he's already in his new apartment and he's like passed out on the floor?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, and then he sits up and bangs his head on the table when Skylar calls.
I believe so. Yeah. That's what I'm starting to think about. Like that, maybe I blocked it out of my mind a little bit. And the second point was, the child, the way that they show them in as children, like that's really subtle, but it's fantastic.
Before you tell us your favorite line, I have a suggestion. Maybe we need to have a tidy whitey counter on our podcast. You know, to figure out how many shots there are. That would be a fun project as we go along.
Yeah, that's I will support you in that if you want to take it up. But yeah, so to go back, like talking about them like children, and my favorite line, it's kind of connected to that because I changed this a couple of times. The first one that I thought about was Walter Jr.'s big moment whenever he says, "Then why don't you just fucking die already?"
Good line.
Just give up or whatever. And I changed it at the last minute because this one hit me, and I didn't necessarily remember it. Of course, I remember that Walt Jr. moment. This one snuck up on me a little bit when I was watching it this time, and it's kind of connected to that idea of them being like children. And he said it's when he's talking to Jake in his bedroom, and he's asking him about this prize that he has, and he tells him, you know, sort of matter of factly what it was, and Jesse responds, "Right on, little bro, making mad inroads with the local business community. Now remember, not all learning comes from books or out of books."
And he taps his temple.
Like yeah. It's such a good, I mean, it's as much as you always, you have to talk about Bryan Cranston and how insanely good he is in all these episodes. Aaron Paul holds his own with some of this stuff. You know what I mean? Like that feels such like a real person, not a made up character on TV to me for some reason. I mean, it's ridiculous. You know, it's a ridiculous thing to say, but it works so well. You know, he takes himself so seriously and trying to be the big bro there and say something, you know, helpful. I absolutely love it.
He delivers his lines perfectly. And I saw an interview with Vince Gilligan once where he was talking about Aaron Paul and his acting and how they were trying to, as they were writing the scripts and the dialogue and everything, like that they couldn't really quite imagine how good Aaron was going to be when he would actually deliver the lines. And so how he kept just like elevating the dialogue. And so he really does have he's so talented, right? And like, of course, when you're up against...
And this one's followed up with another one of my favorites, and that's when he tells him about the piccolo, and he says, "Play some Jethro Tull."
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh man, I love it. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
No worries. I already forgot what I was going to say.
I get excited whenever I think about that Jethro Tull line delivery. It's real. What about your favorite shot?
This one, it has to be Walt walking away from Ken's car as it blows up behind him. So we get this new version of him that leaves destruction in his wake, of course, and this foreshadows many of these other explosive moments. Of course, the scene in Tuco's office comes to mind with the fulminated mercury.
That one's coming up.
Yeah, and then like soon. When he uses the stuff from the Etch-a-Sketch to burn a hole through the place where they steal the methylamine, and then of course the nursing home. And the finale, right? So all these explosions. And it's also a really nice bookend to the opening shot of him in his tidy whitey. So we have him there again, kind of looking like a kid in his tidy whitey's brushing his teeth. And then at the end, you have this like total badass walking away with this explosion behind him. So that's a great shot. What about you? What was your favorite shot of the episode?
This is another one that I switched it up at the last minute. I was going to initially use the one where we see Ken Wynn's, when we see the shot of Ken Wynn's from behind where it focuses in on that Bluetooth. I really love the way they handled that shot. And then I was watching it again, you know, I went back and watched it another time, and I decided that Walt's face when he's looking at the grill, when the chicken's burning, and of course Hank comes over and he says, "Oh, you're burning the shit out of it," or whatever. But yeah, that the look on his face, it's just a tight shot. There's not much else going on. You see the light, you know, you see a little bit of the landscape in the background, a tree and the sky, but It's just the perfect, like, you know, you said that him walking away was a you know, like a bookend to that goofy look. It's the same sort of thing here. I mean, this is a guy, when you're looking at it, you're sort of thinking like, what's going on with him? You know? And I, at least for me, I can say that I kind of forgot about the fact that he's dealing with just murdering a Domingo. So you know, it's a great shot, and it's one of those things, like you were just talking about what Vince was saying about Aaron Paul's acting, and I had just read this article yesterday when I was doing some research for something else, and he was talking about why people rooted for Walt for so long, so much longer than they should have. And he said, you know, this guy, Bryan Cranston, he just has this kind of face that when you look at him, you think he must be all right. You know, you just want him to win. Something I am paraphrasing, but yeah, that's what this scene, it just really jumped out at me in that way of like, I don't even know what's going on with him right there. Like I just admitted that I forgot that he had murdered him, and that's why he looks like that. But I'm still completely captivated by it, you know.
And yeah, I think it is a great shot, and something that I thought of as I was rewatching it is that it's very evocative of Emilio's remains, right? So like that, whatever parts of him fall through the bathtub. Yeah. You see like kind of like, it looks almost like a beef roast or something like that. So that's what it made me think of as he's watching it burn there. And yeah, Hank comes up and he's like, Emerald's going to need another pack. Bam. So this idea of like burning flesh, that's quite literally what just happened. Right. So we saw that how this body was disincorporated using chemicals, right, with the hydrofluoric acid. So maybe perhaps that's what it was reminding him of. I mean, that's enough to make you lose your appetite.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And like I said, he has a lot on his mind. He is dying. He does need to tell his family. He has just, you know, taken someone's life. And what a great job of acting right there. Doing not much of anything, but just, you know, really, really somehow managing to, with the combination of the way it's shot, this is really tight and close, and what everything else is going on, the sound of the chicken sizzling there, like it all works together to deliver that in a really great way.
If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to follow our podcast and hit that bell for notifications. Please rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts. As a new podcast, we greatly appreciate your support.
Yeah, that all really helps. And if you want to support us and get these episodes ad-free, you can join us on our Patreon. And that is patreon.com Growth Decay Transformation.
And you can connect with us on Twitter at BreakingBadGDT.
And please do write to us and send us feedback at breakingbadgdt@gmail.com.
And you can find producer Talitha's Instagram at Talitha_makes_things.
Thanks for listening, and join us next week when we'll be discussing gray matter.